Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. Please be seated. In our first matter today, 2022-0987, in the matter of State versus Palmer, on behalf of the appellant, John Hill.
Morning, Your
Good Honor. Morning.
Are you calling me to the podium? My apologies.
I've been told that I'm responsible for timekeeping now. Is this going to start running, or do I have to hit something?
So you don't have to hit anything. The marshal will take care of that for
you. Okay, great.
Green, you're good to go.
Right. And
just like a stoplight. Yellow, caution, you're running out of time. Red, full stop.
And as a courtesy, I anticipate reserving about 3 minutes for rebuttal.
But fantastic.
I know it's my duty to watch the clock here. So with that, good morning, Madam Chief Justice, Your Honors. May it please the court. This case ultimately boils down really to the issue that I raised in Phillips' second proposition of law. That would be the one concerning the proper extent of the trial court's role as gatekeeper of the self-defense jury instruction. I originally submitted another proposition of law concerning the quantum of evidence that was incumbent upon Phillip to produce in order to avail himself of that instruction in light of the recent amendments to revised code section 290105. But during the pendency of this case, the court seemingly resolved that issue in State versus Messenger, which basically held that the defendant must put forth legally sufficient evidence in order to be entitled to that instruction, and I believe the court explicitly held that it was not modifying the quantum of evidence. So with that, as this court acknowledged in Messenger, the burden upon the defendant in terms of production is not a high one, and it is one that could potentially be satisfied through the state's own evidence. And in this case, Phillips submitted to the trial court evidence that he believed satisfied, under a sufficiency analysis, all of the elements of self-defense, and that is his position on appeal. The trial court's only job under a sufficiency analysis was to construe that evidence most favorably to Phillip, and then to determine, without making any assessments of credibility or any findings of fact, whether that evidence, if believed, would warrant an instruction on self-defense. And here I would submit that the trial court essentially did the opposite of what it was supposed to do. During the course of the trial, there was a lot of discussion about whether or not Phillip would be entitled to a self-defense instruction. And there's a long colloquy, I believe it's on the May 5th, 2021 portion of the trial transcript. It's around page 260, where the trial court goes into its rationale for not giving the instruction. And during that discussion, the trial court made a number of factual findings of what the evidence did and did not say. Pretty much all of them were resolved in the state's favor, and also made the determination that Phillip's testimony was not credible. I can and I will tell you the court why I disagree with the determinations that the trial court made, but the bigger issue is this. Beyond the fact that Phillip indisputably shot the victim in this case, Mr. Young, what actually happened, and more importantly, why the shooting happened, was pretty unclear. There was conflicting testimony from multiple witnesses. Mr. Young's motive for approaching Phillip's car outside of the Marathon station after the dust up between him and Phillip was unclear, and credibility was an issue here. Ultimately, these were factual questions that were supposed to be left to the jury, not the trial court. And we would submit certainly that there was enough ambiguity in the evidence that reasonable minds could disagree whether this was self-defense or not. What happened here is that the trial court improperly took all of these issues away from the jury by failing to instruct the jury on the elements of self-defense. And I will go through those elements of self-defense briefly, and I'll start with actually the third one, which is the duty of retreat, because it's the most simple. Basically, Phillip didn't have a duty to retreat or violate any duty of retreat, because under section 2901.09, he was legally in a place where he lawfully was allowed to be, and he was in his vehicle, and he had no duty to retreat.
What was the evidence that he needed to use deadly force?
Well, so that's...
I mean, you have someone who doesn't have a gun or no sign of him having a gun, at best running towards the cab, why did he need to use deadly force?
Well, so that gets to the second element, which is reasonableness. And I think there are a number, well, so under the analysis of reasonableness, it's a sufficiency analysis. So the trial court, what they had to do was put it in a light most favorable to Philip and determine whether his belief in the necessity of the use of deadly force was reasonable. And really, what that analysis ultimately boils down to is whether he believed reasonably that he was in light or in danger.
So it's an objective criteria, reasonableness. It's not his subjective analysis.
It is a subjective analysis, I believe.
Well, it's reasonableness. Isn't that an objective analysis?
Well, it's, as the court said in State versus Thomas, it's really both. But ultimately, what this court said in Thomas was that ultimately it's a question for the jury to decide whether or not it was reasonable. That's not part of the gatekeeper function. It's incumbent upon the jury to determine whether what the belief of the defendant was, whether or not that was reasonable.
Counsel, your client testified on his own behalf, is that correct?
He did.
And does he have a criminal record?
He had no criminal record. I believe there was some kind of a, there was something way back in the 1970s or to that effect where he had been charged with some kind of a homicide, and I think it got reduced to an assault or something. It got resolved very favorably. I don't believe he did any prison time on it. There was some kind of a self-defense. I don't really know.
What was the thrust of the state's cross-examination?
Off the top of my head, I can't really recall what that got into. I mean, I know there was some discussion about his Vietnam War record, the fact that he was a marksman and things of that nature, but...
He was a veteran?
He was a veteran.
Okay.
So proposition of law number two is really what you're focusing most of your argument on, about conflicting evidence that a trial court shouldn't resolve. And you're essentially conceding that there does have to be evidence that tends to support each and every element of self-defense. So the tending to support is something that isn't necessarily defined in statute, nor have we defined it in Messenger. So does this tending to support have any relevance to proposition of law number two regarding the conflicting evidence?
And Your Honor, with all due candor, I've approached this oral argument with the assumption that the state really did kind of resolve my first proposition of law in Messenger, because it said pretty point blank that the analysis here is sufficiency of the evidence. And I know that we argued and the Ohio public defender argued for a lesser standard, but the court seems to have resolved that issue. That ship has kind of sailed, I believe.
But do we, because of that, I mean, Messenger did not define or clarify what tending to support or tends to support means. Is there an opportunity for us to do that when your focus is mainly on Prop 2?
You know, Your Honor, with all due candor, I don't really have an answer to that question. So going back to Justice DeWine's question, I believe you asked whether what the evidence was that would tend to support the notion that he believed that he was in danger of death or serious physical harm. Is that correct, Your Honor?
Right. What was the evidence that he needed to use deadly force? I mean, why not roll up the window, lock the doors?
So basically,
wave your gun at him. He's the one with the gun. The other guy doesn't have a gun.
Well, so there are a couple of things there. First of all, there are really two parts of this analysis, whether the belief was honest and whether the belief was reasonable. And as to that second point, I believe the trial court actually misapplied the law here to the extent that it considered alternative reasonable means, because if you look at Revised Code 2901.09c, basically it says that you're not to consider other avenues of escape or defusing.
Well, he can't consider retreat, but he certainly can consider other options other than using deadly force.
But it says that you're not supposed to, you know, consider any of that in terms of...
You're not supposed to consider the possibility of retreat.
Right. Right.
Are you asking us really simply to perform error correction here?
I mean, there's a colorable argument to be made here, but I believe that there's a real legal issue here, because there's been a number of these cases that have cropped up. And, Your Honor, I believe you addressed this in State versus Keene, where these trial courts keep, you know, inserting themselves into making, resolving these factual analysis here. And it's not clear, especially in what you referenced, what does tend to support mean? What is the analysis here, as was addressed in Messenger? You know, what the trial court's actual role is in this. And I believe that that issue does need clarification. So getting back to Justice DeWine's question, you asked what evidence could be in support of the notion that he had a reasonable belief in the death or serious physical harm, which would beget the use of corresponding force. And basically, as the court said in Thomas, you have to put yourself in the position of the defendant with their particular characteristics, with the surrounding circumstances, and then their knowledge or lack thereof. And I would just go through the following. He's a 71-year-old cab driver. He's an older gentleman. He's in declining health. He's previously been assaulted, robbed, shot at during previous fares.
Counsel, he didn't start this confrontation with a decedent, did he?
I don't believe that he did. Now, I know the trial court disagreed with me, and the reason that
I'm talking about not the initial at the cab, but what led up to this. He was trying, he was taking him home legally.
Right, he was taking him home legally.
He was legally in possession of a firearm.
Legally in possession of a firearm. There's a relatively intoxicated gentleman in his back seat. The guy passes out. He wakes up, realizes he doesn't like what the fare meter says. He gets belligerent. He starts cussing my client out and saying all manner of things to him, demands that he be driven to the Marathon station. My client complies with that, and that's when he informs him, hey, I'm not paying you. Yeah. And so my client, obviously, he goes inside, and he says, hey, pay me. He has a legal right to do that. He doesn't have to sit back and be a victim of a theft.
Did he try to call the police?
Well, so he asked bystanders to call the police. I guess he had his cell phone in his car, and he had no help from bystanders. And in fact, I would submit that everyone in the convenience store was somewhere between indifferent or actively hostile to his situation. He had no friends in that convenience store. I mean, he was an outsider.
So he went to trial with attempting to assert self-defense as his defense.
Correct.
There's nothing.
There was no dispute that he shot this gentleman.
So, I mean, he was prevented from having that issue considered by the jury.
Right, and he was guilty. I mean, he was guilty the minute that instruction got denied, at least of the felonious assault. I know he got acquitted of the attempted murder, but
there would have been no point in going to trial if.
I mean, it basically took away. He wanted to have his case tried by a jury, and the case was essentially taken away from the jury. But, you know, I do want to touch, I'm running low on time here. I do want to touch on Justice DeWine's question really quickly here, and I was going through it. I think I talked about Mr. Palmer's characteristics, obviously older gentleman, declining health, previous assaults by disagreeable fares like Mr. Young. He had just been assaulted in a convenience store by a drunk, angry, belligerent individual who was much younger, bigger, and stronger than him. He had retreated from that situation.
Okay, that's I guess his subjective part of it. What about the objective part of the test?
Also, the objective part is whether it's a sufficiency analysis, is whether any reasonable person could find that under these circumstances, and I'm going through these circumstances, and I think under the particular circumstances here, you could objectively find that a reasonable juror could reasonably find that he had a reasonable and honest belief that he was in danger of great death or death or great physical harm. You know, he left the convenience store. He is crouched over in his cab. He's got his back turned. He is approached behind by the person who just assaulted him moments ago. This person doesn't announce himself. He doesn't say what he wants. I think under that particular set of circumstances, you could draw the conclusion that this guy's trying to get the jump on you. Being as you're crouched over, you know, you're vulnerable. He could beat the snot out of Mr. Palmer if he wanted to. And again, as I referenced in response to Justice Donnelly's question, Mr. Palmer was an outsider in this situation. He had no friends at that convenience store. So he, under the circumstances, used the amount of force that he believed was necessary. And I see I'm at the 2-minute mark, so I will reserve my 2 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. On behalf of the state, Mr. Horton.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. Justices, may it please the court. My name is Nick Horton. I represent the state of Ohio. Your Honors, this case is about upholding the court's role as the gatekeeper of what issues make it to the jury. Now, I know the defendant focused primarily on the second issue, but I would like to touch on the first issue since it was a significant portion of the defendant's brief and the amicus brief, and then move into the second proposition. So the defendant's first proposition of law asks this court to find that the phrase tends to support means that the defendant could put forward any evidence, no matter how slight, of any element of the offense or of self-defense and have the instruction given to the jury. That would essentially usurp the trial court's position as the gatekeeper because any evidence is such a easy burden to overcome and harkens back to sort of the scintilla rule that this court rejected back in Hampden Lodge in 1934.
Counsel, are you asking us to reverse or modify Messenger?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying that Messenger, I think, upheld what the state is requesting. So in Messenger, this court held that the Senate Bill 228 changes were procedural, not substantive, meaning that the burden of production to get the instruction to the jury has remained unchanged.
And the opinion said the burden was a slight one.
Correct.
Right?
But it's been the same burden as it has been since State versus Robinson, State versus Melchior, which is sufficient evidence of every element of self-defense such that a reasonable juror could find reasonable doubt based on self-defense. What the defendant is arguing is something even less than that, and borders, like I said, on the scintilla rule. Well, and when there's...
Let me ask you that. If this is scintilla, like, credibly or not, Do you agree there was evidence that a combative, violent, extremely drunk person rushed at the defendant in this case?
So some of those are more of a legal conclusion rather than they are a factual conclusion. Yes, he was intoxicated, and yes, there was physical acts of, I guess, violence in shoving the gentleman inside the store. And rushing, now, the defendant
did
agreed
he
when
testify
he...
to that?
He said he came at him faster than lightning.
Okay.
But then during his testimony, agreed on film that he was walking over. He said it was like a quick walk.
So his credibility was, on cross-examination, was questioned about his original assertion under oath?
Yes. Yes, the state walked him through the elements of the offense and walked him through certain statements that he made in conjunction with what was on the video. Yes.
So there's good arguments to be made by the state in closing argument at that point as to why not to believe his version of the testimony.
Sure.
So why shouldn't he have that opportunity to have the jury decide this question?
So I think... Going back to Hampden Lodge, I think that it sums it up pretty well. So in Hampden Lodge, the issue was a negligence with the gas pipes. And there was a slight bit of evidence that the defendant had a duty to maintain those pipes. Now, that evidence was not legally sufficient, which this court found, but because there was slight evidence, it went to the jury. And what happened was the jury found for the plaintiff. And this court had to step in and say, no, this is not legally sufficient evidence to render a finding for the plaintiff. And so this never should have gone to the jury. And so when we have issues that there is no legally sufficient evidence of self-defense, we shouldn't be tasking the jury with making a finding that a reasonable juror cannot make.
But when you're talking about reasonable or insufficient evidence of self-defense, that gets to the burden of persuasion. And it seems like the trial court here did that, looked at the evidence and said it's not sufficient, it's not persuasive, therefore I'm not giving the self-defense instruction, where the defendant's burden was on production only, to get the instruction, and then up to the jury to decide whether it's credible.
Right. But if a reasonable juror could not find that it was, could not find reasonable doubt based on self-defense, then the jury instruction shouldn't be given at all. So it is a sufficiency. The defendant is tasked with pointing to or producing sufficient evidence such that a reasonable juror could find.
So you're saying a reasonable juror could not find, excuse me, that a cab driver who's being shafted out of his fare, who's in his 70s, with a fare person who's riding who was, I think, what, in his 20s, who was intoxicated, who came after him, that 70-something-year-old could not be fearful that he would be harmed?
Not fearful that he would be harmed, because he used deadly force. So what we're talking about is an imminent fear of great bodily harm or death. And what we have, even going back to 1852 in Stewart versus State, this court has said, when you're faced with non-deadly force, when you are in, say, mutual combat, you do not have the right, even if you are fearful, to shoot the other person or to kill the other person, to use deadly force. And that's exactly what we have in this case. So the only evidence we have of the violence between the victim and the defendant, number one, the defendant was the one that started the physical confrontation in pushing the store clerk inside of the store. Then we have the victim who pushed the defendant, and pushed him twice, but not enough to push this elderly gentleman over. So when the victim comes back over to the defendant, the only evidence we have of violence was a shove, and the circumstances surrounding that shove were that the defendant was right in front of him and asking or demanding his money. In the defendant's own words, he was demanding his money.
Why did the victim go back to the cab just before he was shot?
So it depends on if you're asking what the state believes or what we're supposed to say as the evidence in light most favorable to the defendant, because those are a little bit different. So what the state says is that the defendant called him over because the victim's phone was in his car. We had a witness that testified that he heard the defendant call him over. But if you're asking about the what's the evidence in light most favorable to the defendant, the evidence in that evidence is that we don't know. That the defendant or the victim was simply coming back over to the car. Now, the victim said he believed that he was coming over to do him harm or kill him, but we have no evidence of that.
So the victim denies calling him back to get his cell phone.
Yes, he did. He denied on the stand calling him back.
Well, the defendant, I think, made a statement that he was coming toward him rather quickly.
He did.
And
yes.
I think that may have caused some alarm. But so, if I'm a trial judge, you know, I understand after Messenger that there has to be some evidence of each and every element of self-defense. But when I'm a trial judge and I'm making that discretionary decision about whether that evidence tends to support that particular factor as far as sufficiency goes, what definition do I use? Can I apply this? And when I've got conflicting evidence, you know, one might be a scintilla, the other might be tends to support. Can I apply this tends to support in the situation where there is conflicting evidence regarding a particular factor or element?
So the court shouldn't be resolving issues of fact. It should be taking the evidence in the light most favorable to the defendant. But just because the evidence in a light most favorable to the defendant is not trying to think how to put this. Evidence in light most favorable to the defendant doesn't mean we make up evidence. Doesn't mean we speculate. So if the defendant says, if there's no testimony as to who started the affray, we can't assume that the defendant did not. We can't assume that he did, but we can't assume that he did not. So we can't make up evidence. So the evidence was that the defendant followed the victim into the store.
To get the money that was owed to him.
Correct, yes. The evidence was that the victim had shoved him, and the evidence was that the defendant shot him through the neck when he approached the vehicle after that. So whether or not that's sufficient for any reasonable juror to say, yes, that's reasonable doubt based on self-defense is a legal issue. We're supposed to resolve the factual issues or construe the facts in favor of the defendant, not necessarily construe the legal issues in favor of the defendant.
But so is the trial court, I'm sorry.
What does tends to support mean to you? What would we tell a trial judge that means?
It means the same thing it's meant since Robinson, that that it's only where a reasonable juror could find every element of self-defense.
No, I'm saying regarding a particular element, what does it mean?
It means the same thing as Robinson, that a reasonable juror could make that finding. And if it's purely speculation, if there is no evidence, then the jury cannot speculate. It should not be given to the jury.
Can a trial court judge take into consideration his or own perception of the witness's credibility at that making that decision?
No, he shouldn't. So, and there were a few occasions where the court indicated, it appeared that it indicated that it was taking into consideration the defendant's credibility, but it really played no part in some of the decisions that were made, because I believe that the defendant's self-defense argument fails on all levels, that he voluntarily entered the situation, that he didn't have a objectively reasonable belief that he was in imminent danger of death or great bodily harm.
And those sound like great arguments that you could have made to the jury, but that was prevented from happening here.
But if no reasonable juror could make that finding, then the court is tasked with not giving that over to them to avoid something like Hamden Lodge, or when courts or when juries lose their way in manifest weight cases.
How could a judge make that determination in this case when there's directly opposing evidentiary testimony without considering credibility? He didn't believe this. You had effective cross-examination on him from the state, and he didn't believe it, and he decided as a matter of law the jury shouldn't decide that issue.
Right, because as a matter of law, you cannot use deadly force when all you are faced with is a shove. No threats, no nothing. So as a matter of law, you can't do that. And I just wanted to touch on something that the defendant raised about the only means of escape. The only means of escape is not to be conflated with the duty to retreat. The court did not, or the legislature did not remove that requirement. And I think the Sixth District put it well in State versus Smith, where it discussed it as no other means to protect oneself. Mm-hmm. And I think that that sort of sums it up a little bit better than no other means of escape. But that is still it's still at play.
Counsel, one other question. Testimony, you concede, is evidence. Testimony,
yes,
is evidence.
It is. But there's a difference between, for instance, if the victim or the defendant said, "Hey, I saw this defendant earlier. He had a gun. I know he's known to carry a gun. He said he's he'd blow me away, and he's coming over at him. Maybe then we have, sufficient evidence to get it to the jury. But when you say, I saw the defendant coming at me, I don't know if he has a gun, I didn't see his hands, he made no threats to me, that's not of a sufficient nature and quality to make it to a jury. And I see my time is just about expired, so we would ask this court to affirm. If there are no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hill, you have 2 minutes, 3 seconds.
Very briefly. Going back to Justice Brumer's question about tends to support relative to each element, I would just suggest that it's non-speculative evidence that if believed would support each of those particular elements. Now, I just want to close by saying that who was at fault here in creating the situation that led to Mr. Young getting shot was ultimately a question of fact that would have been left to the jury.
But to be met with deadly force, did the victim on the record, in the record show, is there any demonstration that the victim did anything that provoked deadly force?
I think you have to look at the totality of the circumstances to make that determination, and it's ultimately a factual matter whether Mr. Palmer's belief in the necessity of the use of deadly force and whether he was at risk of great bodily injury or death was ultimately a factual matter. It's not a matter of law. And I would say similarly, and related to that, is that there was factual dispute why Mr. Young went back towards Mr. Palmer's car right after he assaulted Mr. Palmer in the convenience store, and there was probably some dispute relative to what his intentions were.
But did Mr. Young touch him at all when he went back to the car?
I don't think he got that far. He got shot before he made his way to the car. But, ultimately, at the end of the day here.
Well, he could have been going back to the car to get his cell phone.
He could have been going back there to jump him. Based on the circumstances, I think that's a fair conclusion. You know, it was only moments after he'd assaulted him, and he was angry and wound up, and he'd already shoved him twice. And the only reason Mr. Palmer didn't end up on the ground is because he hit a solid plate glass door.
Believing that you're in great bodily harm that there's a threat of great bodily injury, subjective and objective, both of those have to be considered by the trial court, don't they?
I believe they have to be, if you read Thomas, they have to be considered by the jury, ultimately. I mean, the only question for the trial court is whether, you know, any juror could find that or not find that. So I see my time is up. So thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you will receive a copy of the decision from the court. Thanks for your time.